Welcome to the Digital Velocity Podcast, a podcast covering the intersection between strategy, digital marketing, and emerging trends impacting each of us. In each episode, we interview industry veterans to dive into the best hard-hitting analysis of industry news and critical topics facing brand executives. Now, here are your hosts, Tim Curtis and Eric Martinez.
Today on the Digital Velocity Podcast, we're excited to welcome Barbara Turley, an accomplished investor, entrepreneur, and visionary founder and CEO of the Virtual Hub. Under her leadership, the company's emerged as a leading force in integrating highly trained virtual assistants into businesses, revolutionizing operational efficiency and digital marketing strategies. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. Excited to be here.
Yeah, you bet. Excited to dive a little bit deeper into this. So we had the privilege, obviously, of talking a little bit before the show. Before we get into some of the topics today, would love for you to share just a little bit of that background with the listeners.
Sure. At the moment, these days, I live between two continents. I'm very lucky to be able to live between Europe, where I'm originally from, and the beautiful beaches of Sydney, Australia, where I spent 20 years. And I've built a company that enables me to do that. It's really irrelevant where I am. Some of that is to do with the type of business that I'm in. However, I'm very passionate about the fact that the right operational frameworks, the right model and the right approach and the right distributed teams and things like that actually enable you and many, many business owners and even people on your team to actually live anywhere. So we have people in the US, obviously a lot of people in the Philippines, people in Australia, South Africa, Ireland. I'm in France at the moment, so it really doesn't change anything about how we run the company.
That's so amazing. You said 10 years you've been running Virtual Hub?
Yeah, it's coming up to about 10 years, nine and a bit. And I've also had two kids in that time. So I'm a very passionate mom first entrepreneur. I believe in automation and delegation and systems really free you to kind of live life on your terms, I suppose, the way you want to do it. And you just do it your way. I've always kind of done it my way, you know, regardless of the rule book.
I think that's healthy to build a company like you've done, but to set it up in a way that allows you to still place priority in the things that are most important in life. I think that's fantastic. Let's dive in a little bit about that. You know, we've heard that term virtual assistant for some time now. That did not start, just as news to everybody, that did not start at the pandemic. That was well before the pandemic. For people at different times, they thought, well, what exactly does that mean for me? How would I use a virtual assistant? There's a wide variety of virtual assistants out there. There's all sorts of different ways you can engage them. Why don't you give us a little bit of a definition of your term of virtual assistant and how you see virtual assistants today?
Yeah, that's a great question. And thank you for starting there, because I think, you know, the term virtual assistant, like you said, has exploded onto the scene. It's been there for decades, to be totally honest. Big companies have been using offshore strategies and stuff like that for a long time. But especially since the pandemic, a lot more people are talking about this concept of virtual assistants, and they exist in every country. But I think it's really important to remember the word assistant in there. And I think this is where the break happens sometimes with expectations, because the word virtual assistant has turned from anyone with a heartbeat who can type into like someone who can code an app. There's a lot of depth and it's very broad, that term. But I do think that the point of having a virtual assistant is really to focus on that assistant word. And that's the word that seems to get forgotten by a lot of people. And therefore, people are hiring VAs, as we call them. And the expectation can sometimes be a little too off the charts. And similarly, some people are advertising themselves online as virtual assistants when actually they're like online business managers. You know, I feel the term has kind of gotten too broad. And that brings me to my kind of philosophy around, you know, how to structure a company or how to use virtual assistants. Really, the way I see it is in every business, no matter the size, it doesn't matter if it's a $1 billion company or a very small business. In every business, there are departments, and I'm going to oversimplify this for a second, but there are departments. You know, there's marketing and sales and product delivery, product creation, legal, whatever, all the different departments. And within each department, there are really two buckets of things that need to be done. There are recurring tasks and processes, and there are project type things. Recurring things are the types of workflows that keep the engine of a business moving daily, weekly, monthly, etc. And within that bucket of things, you will always find things that are being done the same every time, the same every week. When something like that is happening, it means that you can create a process for it. Again, I'm oversimplifying, but a lot of people forget that you can process map something. And once you can process map something, you can usually train it, and then you can delegate it. And actually, you can turn it into what I call the support layer of a department. So not everything requires super IP or the most strategic and creative people in a department to execute every day. And you've got to find all of that support layer stuff, process map it up. And this is where you can really, really leverage the concept of virtual assistants, because you can train them to execute on these things every day, every week, every month, whatever. And it frees up key people in any business, even if that's just the owner, to be focusing on the work that moves the needle. And that's kind of the way I see the use of virtual assistants, and to make sure that you're actually thinking strategically about tasks to be done, jobs to be done, as opposed to roles, full-blown roles. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You know, a little bit of my own story in relation to virtual assistant. I probably had the textbook definition in my mind of a virtual assistant, which was really that admin assistant role that I had been used to. I'd had an admin for years. And it wasn't until I had a very specific need. I was working in PowerPoint. I needed to create an org chart. For anybody out there who's worked with PowerPoint, it is the absolute worst tool ever developed in the world. And to put an org chart in there, it just always messes up. You drop another box in and it changes the whole thing. I was at a fit of frustration. I've been working on it for probably about 3 hours, couldn't get it to undo itself. And then I thought to myself, well, wait a minute. I know there are virtual assistants that can do this stuff. And I actually threw a job out on a virtual assistant board. I had a gentleman from Melbourne, Australia, who said, I can do that. And he says, I can do it while you're asleep. And so I said, okay, fine. I woke up the next morning. He had delivered it. It was there. It was perfect. It was the first time where I thought, I need to change the way I think about the term virtual assistant, because you're right, it's not this very narrow definition of what a virtual assistant could be. There are all sorts of potential use cases for what you could do with a virtual assistant. I found that, if anything, the problem was me. I wasn't thinking broadly enough. Yeah, exactly. That was a real life lesson for me on how I need to change my paradigm.
You know, I think what's really important point to make there as well is that person who did that for you did not need to know, didn't have to have specialized IP in your business, what you do, your industry, nothing, even HR. You know, even though it's an org chart, the person can just Google what is that. They don't even need to actually really know what it is. If, you know, so people get all caught up on, well, I want to hire somebody with experience, or I want to hire somebody with whatever. My view is, you want to hire somebody who is enthusiastic about what it is that you do, has the right attitude to life in general, has a sort of a growth mindset, likes to learn, and is trainable, and has the right smarts. You can teach those people anything, to be totally honest. I think people confuse the strategy and execution layers in a business. And I would say, like, there's the strategy layer that's really important to get right, and you want your A players there. And then underneath that, there's the execution layer. And part of that, you will need some people with certain IP or whatever. But there's a huge amount in the execution layer that people underestimate what could be done by an assistant if you put the work in to creating a process, mapping it out. And yes, that's painful, but a VA can actually help you with that as well. And then training it, practicing it, delegating it. And while that is a lot of work, some people listening are like, I don't have time for that. That's usually what I hear. I don't have time for that. Yes, you don't have time. But this is this idea of, in any business, slowing down to speed up later. It's a marathon, not a sprint, all these sorts of things. And it is annoying. But the dividends that it will pay you in 6 months or a year's time are enormous, because you will not be doing that job anymore. Whereas if you don't delegate it now and you don't spend the time to offload it properly and successfully, in 12 months' time, you will still be doing it and you'll be frustrated as hell. So for me, for example, I mean, I'm the most impatient person in the world. And the minute I find myself doing something two or three times, I'm like, I wonder if I could process map this and train a VA and delegate it. And I have done that over and over and over again, to the point that now I have a 350 employee company. I work from anywhere in the world, and I've had two children along the way, because delegation is always my first go-to. I always think to myself, what part of this can I delegate? Sometimes I have to do 20% of it. Sometimes it's 50. Sometimes it's 80% of something in the beginning, and then I migrate to 10% over time. But that's okay, because I move on to the next thing then. They just think, I don't have time today.
Just sitting here thinking about that last statement, in some cases, the challenge for people, almost the insurmountable part, is that process mapping. That seems very intimidating. And for a lot of people who don't think process oriented, that just don't think that way, that becomes a real impediment. But you had a really good line there. You say there are VAs that can help with that.
Absolutely.
How nice would that be? I hired a chief operating officer, an integrator, if you will, to come into the business because I needed additional support on the operations side. Now, he does that stuff all day long, process mapping, et cetera. I have no desire to sit down long enough to do that. That's a really good point. You know, having a VA that can actually help with the process to turn over to a VA.
Yeah, because not every business has the capacity or the ability to take on a COO or an operations manager or process mapping genius. And it is painful. It is something, though, I think as a business owner, it is worthwhile. Look, any business owner, you have to learn things that initially you're like, I just hate doing this. But the idea is to try to grow the company, grow the business. A VA can help you process map. Sometimes you may have to just record a Loom video and just talk about it. Get a VA to create a little process map. And here's the trick. When the VA brings it back to you and you spot holes or they make a mistake, that's when you iterate. You don't blame the person. You go, oh, there's a step there that, you know, I just know that bit. And that's how you find the IP that you haven't put into the process, but it's the bit that you didn't realize that you know how to do as you're doing a process, and you got to make that a step or train it. Now, again, a little bit painful, but like I always say, at the end of the day, if you want to move forward, you have to invest time in actually the growth of the business. And if you don't have the ability to take on a COO role or an operations person, then a VA can help massively with process mapping.
It's really funny that you say that because I actually had that situation come up last night. We just hired a new assistant in our company. I had her actually just scheduling some meetings. She scheduled the meeting, but she scheduled it wrong. Yeah. When we were chatting about it, I realized that she saw me say, I want you to schedule a meeting between these people and assume that she was going to read the whole thread. You know, she's new to the company and our culture and working with me. And I said, you know what? That was my bad. I should have made sure that my expectation that was you're reading the thread so you understood the context in order to make sure that the right people are on the call. Not a big deal, really easy to iterate and solve that problem.
You know, some people would say, well, my expectation of someone is that they should have that knowledge. The way you around that would be to say, well, first, never assume anything, right? But what you could do there is rather than having to write all the instructions, because you're thinking, well, it's in the thread, you could just say, make sure to read the thread to get the context. And then, you know, wait to see the mistakes. It might be easier just to say what you want, but.
I was moving fast. And you know how that goes, right? Sometimes you're moving so fast and you forget a step because you've been doing it so often for so long that, oh, right, I do those things. But how would they know if I don't communicate it to them in some way, shape, or form? And that's where you have to iterate. So Barbara, it's kind of shifting into the idea of innovating remote work. Given your extensive experience working with remote teams, what innovative strategies have you found most effective for managing and scaling work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And something that's been a game changer for us over the last 2 years. Like I've tried lots of things over the years. The first iteration I did, well, it wasn't really an iteration. I just sort of stumbled upon it and it worked in the early days, is I'm a huge fan of the Asana platform. Now, those who don't use Asana, there are other tools that do that sort of thing. But I do like the way that a company is iterating over time to move into this future of work type thing. But a couple of years ago, I started to implement objectives and key results. That has been an absolute game changer for speed of execution, for me eradicating about 70% of meetings out of my calendar and being able to work completely async. So how that works is when you've got a lot of people, they're all working on stuff and everyone's really busy. But sometimes as the COO or the CEO, the problem is that you're like, yeah, but we're not getting any results, or where are the results? And you're chasing people for updates, or you have recurring meetings in your calendar every week where, you know, a team member has to come on and give you an update, or you're waiting in Asana for updates. What ended up happening to me was that the company got so big that I just couldn't manage that anymore. And I was looking for a new way to do it. Now, Google started using objectives and key results, I think in year one of Google, like way back in the early 90s. And I started researching this and it just made so much sense to me. And basically I said objectives and key results, and please Google it for those that are interested in doing this, but setting objectives and key results for the company as a whole, and then having each department set objectives and key results of what that department can do so that we achieve those goals. So what's their part that they're going to play in it? And then you cascade those down to the teams and make sure that every project or every workflow or every pipeline or whatever it is that people are working on, they must connect it to a key result of the department. This thing I do every day, what's it driving? Is it driving a key result? And if it's not, we need to ask ourselves, or should we be doing that anymore? Or what is the purpose of this work? And with that, we brought in a method of status updates, because realistically, I thought to myself, what do I really want to know? Or what does a COO person really want to know? We really want to know, are we on track or off track with our key results and our objectives for the year? And if we're off track, what's the roadblock? And do I need to step in to help remove the roadblock? Because if something's tracking towards goals and metrics, well, maybe we don't need to have this meeting every week. Maybe we're just on track. And then we can have love and connection calls instead of all these update meetings. So that's been a huge thing for us. And it has increased our speed of execution a lot, a lot.
Yeah, I had a very wise friend who used to repeat this. He actually was a recruiter. And he kept saying, one of the key things you need to know is, do your people know how they connect to the bottom line? And you're saying the same thing in a different way, but it's the same concept. Do they know how they connect to the bottom line and how that makes a difference in the company? I've worked for a lot of small companies. I've run my own small company, and I can't say that we always get that right.
I've worked in big companies that don't get it right. It's just a way of working. But I think once you work in that way, all of a sudden location becomes irrelevant and trust becomes irrelevant too. Because the big debate online at the moment about, oh, you must trust your people, and oh, you must trust this, that and the other. It's the wrong conversation to be having. I think we just need to forget trust. I'm not saying don't trust. I'm saying just move that aside, because it's a very emotional concept. Trust to one person means something different to the next person. And trust can be broken quite easily, sometimes by one person who doesn't realize they've broken the trust of the other because we see it differently. You know, so I prefer to say, well, let's forget that as a concept and let's create a way of working so that we are driven by collaborating on roadblocks, making sure that we're all rowing the boat in the one direction at the same speed towards the same goals, and that we all understand those things and we understand how our work connects to that. And that's very powerful, doing it that way.
You know, we work with a lot of e-commerce companies. I guess my question is, how do you utilize virtual assistants specifically to optimize operations? I know you talked a lot about maybe, you know, some automation elements. Obviously, you've talked about process mapping. Are there more specifics on how you get inside of a company to potentially deploy those virtual assistants to really start to optimize and streamline what they're doing from an operations standpoint?
Do you mean so that we can free up the time of the people who are currently doing the doing? Or do you mean to make sure that the VAs are working properly?
More with the goal to free up the people that need to be freed up. What we oftentimes see in companies, especially when we do some of our own consulting, what we find is that oftentimes companies are over leveraged. In other words, they have their highest leverage employees, their highest seasoned employees working on things that really are not a high return. No. That need to be handled by someone who is not at that level of seniority. So that's kind of the idea, is to free up those kind of resources to do and to provide for the business things that have a real return.
Absolutely. So I talk about this all the time. What's interesting about that actually is that when your key people, so let's call those your key needle moving strategic people in any business. And it doesn't matter, actually, we work with lots of e-commerce businesses, but we also work with financial services companies. We work with yoga teachers. We work with all like coaches, all sorts of gamut of industries. Your key people, when those people are bogged down in the doing, that's a different brainwave state than when they're in creation and strategic mode. And it's actually quite difficult to shift from all the busy work and the doing, 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 and shift your brain state into what you want them to be doing. What you're paying for actually is their time and energy to be focused on stuff that's going to move the company forward, strategy creation, etc. It doesn't actually matter what type of company we're talking about. And we have done this for a lot of e-commerce businesses as well. But I'll go back to what I said at the beginning of the show, where when you break any company into their constituent pieces, which is the departments, and then you look at what are all the jobs to be done in these departments, and you start to split out, you call it a stop doing list, right? We all want to create to-do lists, but it's better to look at all the stuff that needs to be done in every department within reason. I mean, start with a few areas and figure out, like I said, what stuff is kind of rote, processy, probably below the pay grade maybe, or the intellectual grade of the person that's currently doing it. And usually what happens is they know that it would make more sense for an assistant to do that role, but it doesn't maybe make sense for an American assistant or to hire someone locally to do that. You need to have a more cost-effective solution there. And how you really make that work is to actually sit down And make your categories departments, and under each department, just start to kind of jot down as a team, what are all these things that I'm doing? And then we've got to make a stop doing list. Process map, by the way, also doesn't need to be difficult. People overcomplicate that. I'm like back of an envelope, couple of bullet points. That's how you start a process. And then you start to slowly delegate to an offshore virtual assistant or whatever and work on making sure that that's delegated successfully. And the idea being that you always want the key people in the brain state of strategy, creation, whatever the thing is, to move the needle forward and focusing on those OKRs and actually making sure that we're actually meeting those things. I know what I started with there about the breaking the company down into the departments. That is actually really key in how you simplify it. Just make that simple structure to start with, and you'll find that that will evolve over time.
And you're not kidding about the tendency to overcomplicate a mapping process. I don't know what it is. You'll say those things and you'll see people, literally, their pulse quicken because they just are intimidated by that.
Because the word process mapping is intimidating. It sounds like engineering or
It does
software.
sound like engineering. That's exactly
Totally.
right. It sounds very complicated, like you need a PhD to complete it.
No, I did a process yesterday for LinkedIn. I mean, I hate doing it as well. I'm actually quite good at it, but I don't like doing it. I just find it tedious, but I also don't like doing all the work. Like, which is the worst evil,
Exactly.
guys? So yesterday I sat down after like 2 weeks of procrastinating, and it was a LinkedIn thing, and I was like, I've got to just, and it's like it was only five steps. I was like, step one, like I just literally go, step one, do this, and then step two, and then I got to step six, and then I went back and sort of added a few little bits because I was like, oh, that person's, I mean, obviously the person would know to hand the baton to the next person involved, but let's just put that in just so there's no holes or no lack of clarity.
The other aspect of that, when you do start to really, number one, get familiar and comfortable with the concept of handing something off, especially someone that is likely sitting overseas somewhere, right? Another country. Once you have finally gotten to a level of comfort with, for so many, is a completely nouveau concept. They've never worked in an environment where they've done those things before. So once you do, then the paradigm of thinking begins to change and you begin to see little things that could be process mapped to make it more automated, maybe, or something that could then flow into a virtual assistant type. And I think with the advent of AI, with the amount of automation that people are putting in, with the dispersed workforce, there's a whole litany of things that we're getting used to now. And I think it's really the exercise that we need to probably conduct ourselves internally within these organizations to say, we need to think through all of our processes because we are working in an unexamined rhythm and we're doing the same things over and over again. And when we really begin to think about those processes, then we can see where, you know, if we did this and we did this and we brought virtual assistants in to help with these parts of the process, we could speed our timeline up.
At the end of the day, when we're building a company, of course it requires entrepreneurial vision because that's how it starts. Most entrepreneurs and founders are visionaries. They have this vision and they move fast and they don't want the detail. It's just so tedious for them to even think about this. But there is a moment where founders and startup entrepreneurs are brilliant at that beginning bit, which is product market fit or product creation. And in a startup, everything is product market fit. And honestly, process mapping and all that stuff, until you've got the product market fit and marketing and sales nailed, to be honest, and the thing is selling, it's when you're scaling up. And that's the point at which what got you there won't get you to the next thing is what every entrepreneur and founder needs to remember, that now we're into the scaling phase. And scaling phase is when the business needs to become a machine. It is quite engineering-like. It needs to be engineered properly. You need the right operational frameworks to put people into so that you can get the best, most efficient use of human capital budgets, if I could put it that way. So you make sure that everything's running like a well-oiled machine. And that sort of thing appeals more to those COO types and integrators than it does to the traditional founder or entrepreneur. But if you're someone who can't hire that other person, you don't need to make it complicated. Literally just bucket out your departments, bucket out what needs to be done. And now you're actually starting to create the bones of a machine. Use tools like Asana for project management and running the company. And then you don't need to be so afraid of putting people in. As Michael Gerber says in his book, The E-Myth, systems run your business, people run your systems. And a system really is actually just a series of smaller processes. And a process is just a series of steps. It doesn't need to be complicated. You don't need big mind maps of processes. Just bullet points on a page will do to start off with. And then you've got the seeds of that sort of thinking that helps people who are more visionary to go, oh, okay, I can handle that. I can do that. You know, that's okay. That's how I started.
So I got a question for you then. There's process-oriented people and there's creative people and the strategic thinkers and all that that you were talking about. And so when you start realizing that you're bumping up against that scaling issue, and you probably bump your head up against that ceiling a couple of times and bounce down, bump up again, hit your head again, that hurts. Why can't I bust through that portion of the ceiling? One of the things I have failed at as a business owner is then I'm like, oh, okay, well, I need a person to do that for me. Okay. And my tendency has been to hire that person in-house and get them geared up. But I really only need about 20% of that person for that particular thing. And then there's 80% of this time and capacity and energy to go on the other things. So hence the concept of a virtual assistant. As you're starting to build that machine and build out the bones, if you are doing this today and you're that entrepreneur bumping up your head against that ceiling, when do you use the VA? And when do you hire that full-time person? Because I think that's always the tricky balance. Like if I have that full-time person, I have the full allotment of their hours. I can utilize them in a variety of different ways, but there are downsides to that particular choice as well. So from your perspective, when is the right time?
So I want to unpack this properly. I'm going to use my own business as the example. So today there's hundreds of staff and great systems and a global presence and all that stuff, but it did not start that way. And I did not have a background. My background, I was always a single contributor type role. I came out of corporate. I did not have an entrepreneurial bone in my body. I actually was an equity trader for a long time, which is very much a, not a single contributor, you are part of a team, but it's just not, I wasn't running a team. I'd never been to the Philippines. I had no background in HR or recruiting or any of that stuff. The original iteration was not a VA company, right? I was actually doing business coaching. I was into automation and systems and all that stuff, but from putting VAs inside client businesses, it actually became apparent that we needed more of that. And I ended up in this business. But it started out with a few VAs thrown together. And what I started doing really was constantly delegating. So continuously processing up, systemizing, training, delegating. And constantly doing that all the time. It is a bit painful, but constantly doing that all the time. And then at some point you get to a stage where you're like, the VAs are full, right? So you fill them first with this support layer type stuff. And then you reach a point where you're like, what I need now is beyond the skill set of that person. That's when you need to start bringing in more strategic players who are experts in their field. There is a great strategy that I used for a long time called a high-low strategy. I used this for a very long time, like until a few years ago, which is basically you have most of the support and processes and work and you're delegating it to your assistants. You're the one running that, though. That becomes, and you start to bump your head up against the strategy thing because you're now head of marketing, head of sales, head of everything, right? But as long as you've got lots of people doing the doing, you can handle that for a while. And then a great strategy is to say, okay, now I don't need a CMO, nor can I afford it, or I don't need a full-time head of something, but you can hire great fractional consultants to come in and actually bridge that gap for a while and still have your doers doing the doing until such time as you're actually big enough to be able to hire people in those high up roles. I hope that's making sense. I think where entrepreneurs get stuck a lot is they try and throw a body at a problem where they go, I'm bumping up against the ceiling. I need to hire an
exactly.
employer who can just handle this for me. They're desperate for someone. They pay big money. Someone comes in, doesn't quite work out. It's hard to recruit in any role. Doesn't matter. I think you're better off first trying to get your delegation muscle working really well. And of course, I'm selling my own book here because I sell VAs. But I mean, this is how I did it. I just kept exercising that delegation muscle and kept delegating to VAs first, before I started to hire the bigger roles. And then when those bigger roles do come in full time, they're like, wow, so I have a team. You won't be doing any of this stuff because we've already, you can refine process or whatever, but you're hiring those people in more strategic roles. So I hope that makes sense. It's just this idea of not throwing a body at a problem. You got to think strategically about what you're doing.
That makes perfect sense. But I think it's also a very uncomfortable spot for some people.
Oh, it's terrible. Even for me, I'm making this sound really easy. It's not. But I mean, nothing in business is easy, though. You know, people who are great marketers, They find that easy, and the vast majority of people don't. I mean, it's the same sort of thing. You're never going to be brilliant or love every department, right? So you have to start to think about how you can grow a business. I mean, unless you got funding, I suppose, but I'm talking about bootstrapped businesses.
As you go through this process and you start using virtuals, are those all contractors? Are they on your payroll? I know I'm getting into a little bit of
Oh
nitty-gritty,
no, I don't mind.
but I think business owners, particularly entrepreneurs or owners of small businesses, don't give themselves the permission to hire the help they need to scale their businesses. And I think this is true at any level of company, but I think it's really true in that small and mid-sized business where you're big enough to have people, but you're still small enough that you don't have everything you need. And that is today's society to a T, in my opinion. Most businesses operate that way. So what do they need to do to give themselves permission and think of it in a framework that makes sense?
There's two tricks for this. The first one is more business focused. The first trick is to say to yourself, nobody is launched a business to work 15 hours a day, 7 days a week. Nobody ever got up in the morning and said, this is what I want to do with my life, right? So let's be honest about that. Everyone looks at the cost. Everyone goes, if I pay a VA, this is how much it's going to cost. I would say, stop that thinking and go, if I was to free up this many hours of my time, well, how much more would I grow this business? I'm tipping that you have the capacity, or your key people, if it's a larger business, to grow, to have more impact than the cost of the VA. So it's really that whole thing of thinking about, well, what would be the impact on the business if I was freed up, and even the brainwave state thing, if I actually was more in that mode than the cost of the VA. Now, just because you can do Canva images doesn't mean that you should be doing, even if you love doing it and you're brilliant at it. I still would say to people, do that for the love of it. But like at the end of the day, the job that you're in, if you're a business owner, is you're in the business of business building. And that is a mindset shift that you've got to get out of technician mode and think about, like, how are we growing this business? And the energy of the owner and the creative mind of the owner and the key people is actually the thing that you want to expand. And the only way to do that is to take the busy work off them such that they can actually move forward. Move the needle. So that's tip number one. But the other tip I think is also really important that nobody ever does is to sit down and forget the business model, forget the business vision for a second. Sit down, and this is what I did. And you map out your personal vision for your life. And you think about, what do I actually want personally? If you were to remove money or success or any of these things from the equation, how do I want to feel every day? How do I want to live every day? And then you work from there and you ask yourself, the business model that I have, does that serve that or does that take away from that? I'm not saying you can change things, but it is a really good mindset to be in to go, it is my life. While we all want to be successful in business, I'm really passionate about this because this is what I did. And every decision I ever make in business is driven by my personal vision for my life first. And I didn't start that way. I've grown into that, but it was I think it's really powerful. And then to remember that probably the person who can probably move the needle the most is usually the business owner and or the other sort of, key roles that you have. Busy work is the death of any business. Delegate or die. That's actually the truth. Yeah.
When you see those organizations where they're needing to give themselves permission, for example, to hire something, typically what you'll see is that same struggle to release or to bring in additional resources. You'll see struggling in other areas of the business. It won't just be limited to this because there's a larger cultural change that needs to happen, which is we need to embrace the concept of engaging others to come alongside and help us.
Look, I think on that point as well, I think there is also a perception out there or a fear that is real where people go, I just don't want to give up control. And my argument would be if you learn to delegate properly, you don't give up control. What you do is you're not the one doing it, but you control the process. I don't feel like I've relinquished control of anything across the business because we now have department heads and all sorts of people, but we still collaborate. And I'll go back to this objectives and key results thing. We are collaborating as a leadership team to figure out, like, well, all the stuff we're working on, are the processes right? Are we getting the results we need? I feel really across things and really in control of things without actually doing any of the doing. So I think we've got to forget this idea that delegation is relinquishing control. It doesn't have to be. We're all control freaks, really. All of us entrepreneurs. We don't like to admit it, but we actually are. And that's okay. It's just a matter of managing that.
Before we pivot here to close, I have a question I'd love to kind of get your feedback on. And it's one that when I do get the opportunity to set either one-on-one with CEOs or chief marketing officers, or I also have a lot of opportunities to sit within CEO groups and to hear kind of what the tone in the conversation is. And the largest, the number one point that was always being discussed in these groups was the tension of hiring in person versus hiring virtually, you know, and the challenge and the back and forth. And what you really found was people had a personal preference and they led with that personal preference. Their bias was somewhat informing the way that they were looking at things. But in this new world in which we live, you know, the concept of virtual, of course, cat's out of the bag, that's done. My question to you is, how do you facilitate a culture and an environment where you maintain those things that are important to you, like culture, while still engaging either in a hybrid environment or in this case through VAs? In your opinion, what's the tricks of the trade there to sort of manage or lead through that?
Okay, so first of all, it takes work. People think that once we go remote, we just work the way we used to work, except now we're all remote. Well, what happens there is connection dies. You can't just take how we used to work and then put it into a distributed model that's remote and distributed all around the world. And I think that's some of the problem in the thinking of people who don't want to, like the ones that are going, we just don't want to do this remote thing. It's a big fear and I get it. And it's real because in their head, they're going, I don't see how we can make our business the way we do it. It's not going to work over there. And they're right. It won't. You need a new model, right? So this is a raging debate on LinkedIn at the moment. If you're following any of the future of work stuff, COVID was an experiment and we were forced into it. But now we have the choice. But in order to make it work and in order to make it successful, you have to put work into the operational frameworks, how we work, how we collaborate, how we communicate. And it is different from being in an office environment. You need to get really good at the boring stuff, which is documentation, which is process mapping, things like how to write a status update rather than have a meeting, and don't write War and Peace. We've created a way of working at the virtual hub that while you want to have, I call it flexibility within a structure. So for example, you bring great people in who do great work and have brilliant experience in a certain area. Great. And you say to them, that's brilliant. However, how we work here is that we work off objectives and key results. We have an update cadence for this that is biweekly or monthly or whatever it is. And how we do it is, in our company, for example, everyone does their status updates in the same way. And it's basically, you know, a summary of kind of where we're at, just like what we've achieved. What's the roadblock? Now, that's really important. And what are we doing next? Because the roadblock is where we may have to trigger a meeting. We may not. We may be like, you know, we can solve that roadblock. And then obviously we're big users of Asana. So like you don't have to use that platform, but you definitely need a place in the cloud where everyone shows up to work, does work, collaborates on work, reports on work, and has this kind of connection. And it's not Slack. Like Slack is just noise, to be totally honest. You can use Slack, but like another rule we have at the Virtual Hub, for example, is that we were using Slack for a while, but Slack is for chat and we can chat about something. But when we agree the instruction must be put at the site of the work. And that's in Asana, whether it's at the task level, the project level, or the objective and key result level, or the team level, the actual instruction is put at the site of the work. And that's the documentation thing. I don't mean big books of documents. I'm just talking about how we actually structure things is different in a virtual environment. That's how you make it work. You move to the new frameworks.
Yeah, I think Asana, as an example, I think there's a lot of those integrations where they will come in with like a Slack, but you have to understand Slack is a wonderful tool. It's amazing how you can communicate and dialogue via Slack. You can maintain a culture. There's a lot of those fun things within Slack, but it is not a project management tool. No. And it is not a replacement for that. So yeah, no arguments here.
I could talk for 4 hours about the operational structure. I mean, interestingly, we've in the last 2 years, because this is such a major problem, we've actually launched an entire department. We have an operational efficiency consulting and implementation team with system architects, and our consultant sits in Sydney. We've got project managers, and we actually do that work for clients where we build Power BI dashboards for them so that they have live feeding data to help make decisions quicker in an online environment and things like that. And I mean, we just launched it because we'd been doing it this way for, like I said, 8 years. I mean, we've been doing this for a long time, and it is a different way of working when you're in a fully remote environment. And those who feel like we can't go to a remote environment, we don't feel like it's going to work, they're probably right, because the way they're currently doing it is probably not going to work in a virtual environment.
No, and it's ripe for change.
Don't get overwhelmed, though. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day. Start with one step. That's why actually bringing on remote VAs can be handy with process maps and stuff, because you can put those in Asana and just start there. And you're like, oh, that's working really well with those remote teams. Maybe we could do this with other people who are not in the office this week or next week or whatever. That's how you build from there.
That makes perfect sense. So just before we move to close, Barbara, we could talk about this all day long. And I would ask you lots of nitty gritty questions, which nobody wants to listen to. But are there any last pieces of advice that you would like to leave the audience with? Because there's a lot to unpack in this particular episode. Yeah. Lots of little action items that you have notated throughout the conversation. If there was one last piece of advice, what would that be?
I'm going to follow on with what I just was talking about in saying that I know you got to start with the end in mind, but that doesn't mean that you today have built what the end is going to look like. Like anything, you know, if you want to move into this digital realm and get digital velocity is what you guys are talking about. I mean, if you want to get digital speed like that in terms of operations and stuff like that, it really is just not getting overwhelmed. Don't overcomplicate it. It actually can be as simple as bullet points on a page to start with, and delegating one small process, a simple one, to an assistant, maybe bringing on Asana and trying that with just a VA and building from there. Otherwise, it will be overwhelming, but it doesn't need to be. It's just slowly, methodically going through each process and slowly delegating. You're not going to delegate all of it in one day. It might take 6 months, but that's okay. Just one step at a time. And that's really powerful. I think people try to go too fast and then they get all caught up and overwhelmed and it doesn't happen.
I think that's right. Many people who listen know I coach fast pitch. That's one of the things I tell the girls when they're making a lot of mistakes. It's usually because they're rushing and not taking time due to things properly so that they can do it faster later down the road. So I think that's very good advice for anything that we do. Barbara, if anybody wants to reach out, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Sure. So I'm putting a lot of content out at the moment on LinkedIn, actually. And we have a process, of course, for that, where I only do the bit that I need to do.
Of course
do.
You do.
Just like this podcast, I only show up and do the podcast. All the other stuff happens in the background. So on LinkedIn, please connect over there. Barbara Turley on LinkedIn. I talk a lot about these topics. And of course, thevirtualhub.com. If you want to pop over there, if you're just thinking about getting a VA or you want to have a chat with us, we've lots of content on our site to help you. And you can also book a call with some of our team and they can help you decipher what we can help you with and if we're the right fit for you, etc.
Yeah. And, you know, everybody remember the VAs aren't just one thing. Lots of different potentials for utilizing virtual assistants in your business. Well, that's it for today's episode of the Digital Velocity Podcast. I'm Eric Martinez from Blue Tangerine.
And I'm Tim Curtis from Coker One.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about how Blue Tangerine and Cohere One can help you generate more sales for your business, visit bluetangerine.com and cohereone.com. If you have enjoyed our show today, please tell a friend, leave us a review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Visit the digitalvelocitypodcast.com website to send us your questions and topic suggestions. Be sure to join us again on the Digital Velocity Podcast.